Hey there, this is Seth Juarez from Channel 9 here in Building 25 with Matt. How you doing, buddy?
Pretty good. How are you?
So tell us who you are and what you do, bud.
So I work for a team called Patterns and Practices. Mm-hmm. We're now officially part of the Azure Customer Advisory Team.
Nice.
So we are underneath Azure now rather than underneath the developer division.
Okay.
So our focus nowadays is not so much on producing libraries and coding tools, but rather on exploring the Azure platform and producing guidance and code samples that are meant to be examples of how to use the platform in the best way.
I see. Traditionally, it was more of like, here's a library that you should use to use MVVM, for example.
Right.
But now you're saying it's a little bit different. Could you be a little bit more specific on what that means?
Sure. So some of the libraries that are still in best use, we've actually transitioned over to different members of the open source community.
Right.
As Microsoft's really trying to embrace open source and be more involved, things like Prism and Unity, which are still very popular and widespread use, actually get better support through the community than they actually ever did through Microsoft.
Oh, cool.
So we're very happy to embrace that change. But our focus these days is really about trying to produce reusable guidance for the Azure platform and for developers trying to bring their applications to the Azure.
I see. So it's less of a use this code and more of a here's some practices when moving to the cloud that would actually be beneficial. Because you can't just move what you have over to the cloud and expect it to be magical.
Exactly. And that's kind of what I want to talk about today.
Okay.
There's this kind of industry common term that nobody's really very well defined anyway. Some people have tried called lift and shift.
Okay.
And the mindset is well, I'm doing something on-prem. I'm just going to move it to the cloud. And we want to enable that as best as possible. And that's mostly true. I mean, we do want people to be able to pick up their applications and move them to the cloud. But it's really important when you do that, that you think about what that really means.
Yeah.
One of the things we see very often is that customers they design their applications for what works on-prem when they know what their workloads are. They know they have so many users, they know they have so much equipment, they know what their performance profiles look like. And the time that they think about moving to the cloud, and this is a general case, I mean, there are exceptions, but the time they think about moving to the cloud is when they say, you know what, we're going to need to scale this app. So they think, I know, I'll move it to the cloud. And what they do is they pick up their application exactly as it was written, put it on a virtual machine in the cloud, and then say, we're done. And unfortunately, that just doesn't work. You can't just design an application for unknown load and just put it in a single instance and expect it to scale. The cloud gives you tools to help you with scalability, but the application kind of has to be designed hand in hand to work with those tools most efficiently.
So in the best case scenario, you can lift and shift, but that's generally a rare case.
Yeah, if the application was designed for scalability to begin with, there are plenty of good parallels in the cloud. Mm-hmm. We have queuing mechanisms, we have background processes, we have virtual machines, we have batch processing. There's lots of things you can do in the cloud that you could also do on-prem. So many applications that were well-designed on-prem work well in the cloud as well.
Right.
But many applications that are running on-prem are not necessarily designed for scalability in the best circumstance.
I see.
So a lot of things I'm going to be talking about today are things that are best practices anyway, whether you're running on the cloud or not.
Okay.
But when you go to the cloud and you expect scale, like imagine you're some small shop and you're trying to be a good tech startup or whatever you're trying to be, and you go public and then you want that traffic, right? Well, what does that mean to your application? It's just because you're in the cloud, just because you're on Azure or another cloud provider, doesn't mean that you're instantly going to have magical features that help your app scale. You have to think about how they work into your application.
I see. Because you might have this great coming out thing, and then all your customers DDoS your site.
Exactly.
And we don't want that. So let's get into the meat of what we're talking about. So we're going to talk about some patterns to help you move your stuff into the cloud, or even if it's on-prem, to make it infinitely more scalable, even if it's on-prem.
Right, and that would be good preparation to moving to the cloud, and it's something you should be thinking about anyway. Now, if you're just creating a personal blog that you don't anticipate much traffic on, or something small scale, maybe some of this doesn't apply, but we're talking about enterprise applications, line of business applications, public-facing applications, things with maybe known load, maybe unknown load, different load patterns being applied. And we really want the developers writing these applications to be able to take advantage of all the power the cloud can offer.
Sure, sure. All right, well, let's dive in.
So the first thing I want to talk about is something we call decomposition.
Okay.
So this may sound fairly obvious, but a very large number of applications have a web app, So maybe this is ASP.NET, or maybe that's Node.js or PHP or some other platform. But really, the platform isn't really that important. And they'll have a database powering it. So maybe, you know, this is a connection to a SQL database.
Okay.
Maybe it's MySQL or SQL Server or
anything.
And this becomes the application. And this is very common. People will say, well, you know, in our environment, we didn't have much load, but maybe we did actually have a web farm. So we'll have maybe two or three instances of this. Yeah. And you know, if you just put this in the cloud, this becomes, you know, Azure websites or web apps, I think I believe they're called now, or a virtual machine or any number of other approaches. And this becomes, you know, Azure SQL DB.
SQL Azure,
right? SQL DB. And this is fine as a start.
Right.
But the load profile, the scalability profile, is going to be the same here as it was here.
I see.
Even though you get this nice little slider that says, yes, I can spin up more nodes just by moving the slider over, that doesn't necessarily give you the scale that you're thinking about.
It's still a web farm,
right,
but in the cloud.
Yeah, so let's think about how we would decompose this app.
Okay.
So I'll give you a real world example. There's a large customer of ours that does image processing. We'll say you know, a photo processing app. People upload their photos, and maybe different filters get applied. They can crop them, they can put funny captions on them, et cetera. You know, it's a social type application. Well, when this application was originally designed, the processing for these images was being done here inside the node of the website.
Like in your MVC controller, for example.
Yeah, you would just have a controller, and you would say, okay, well, the person wants to resize. I've got a method for resize. I pass in the image, and I resize it. You know, or passing in either an actual image object, or maybe I'm passing a binary stream or whatever,
sure.
But I'm doing it inline my website. So at scale, what happens is the CPU of that web process is spending so much time doing image processing that it can't actually serve web requests.
I see.
So we need to decompose that. We logically say, okay, this is something different. This is not serving web requests. It doesn't need to be done in real time on the web. So we put this out into a queue. And we say, okay, we are, you know, going to queue these up when we have requests for image processing, and then we'll have some kind of a background worker node. And it's just going to listen to the queue and pick up messages that say, I have an image that needs to be processed, and it's going to do whatever processing needs to be done and then write the results somewhere. So the disconnected nature of this means that you can't necessarily just sit here on the web and wait for the image to be finished processing,
right?
So there's patterns that you can use to help with that. One thing you might do is poll to say, you know, poll a status flag and say, is it done yet? You might just simply return to the user and say, we've accepted your image. There's a few different things you can do. You might involve something like SignalR to push a message back to the front end. So having that disconnected nature is the key, though. If you didn't recognize this as a piece that could be decomposed and done elsewhere, then you're really impacting the performance of your website.
Of course.
Because think about an image processing site, the majority of the traffic are people viewing the images, not the people uploading the images.
Right.
So you have different load profiles. And if you want to be able to serve a million users or some high number saying, please go, you know, show that page with that image, you don't want the background process of uploading and processing these images to separate that.
So it feels like as you're moving to the cloud, you really need to think about what is it that people are going to do the most, and then optimize for that. And anything that's sort of ancillary that might take a lot of processing time, might take a lot of IO type calls, let's move that to somewhere else. Because I don't think users mind if you go and you say, hey, we got it, we'll tell you when we're done.
Right.
I don't think people mind that.
Yeah, I don't think they do either. And if you want that fluid experience that looks like it's being done in real time, you can design that, like I said, with SignalR and other things. But what you can't do is just say, I'm going to do this on the web service. Now, there's a lot of confusing things out there around this, because there are, like in .NET 4.5.2, there was this queue background worker process that was added. Mm-hmm. And it's essentially for that. I want to do something in the background in real time in my existing process. Right, without accidentally shutting down the application pool.
But it's still affecting that machine.
Right, it's affecting that machine, it's taking up CPU resources, and if you are doing this synchronously, it also could be blocking incoming requests. Now, maybe you could be doing it asynchronously, but it's still going to be taking up compute resources.
Of course, because, I mean, The thing has to be, if it's an image, the thing has to be in memory, and you might want to use memory, for example, for better caching of the images that people want to see.
Exactly.
I see.
Exactly. Okay. So a typical decomposed web app may have one or more queues, one or more background processes, and maybe even not just multiple nodes of the website, but maybe even different websites. And sorry, my drawing's a little off here, but maybe you have two or three different websites, and maybe one of them is web, and maybe one of them is API, and maybe you separate them, maybe one handles reads and one handles writes. There's different ways to think about breaking that down. And so ways we like to think about it is, what is first the logical decomposition? Mm-hmm. So within the application, what are the things that are different, which is what you meant on. And then think about, what is the physical decomposition need to be?
Okay.
And so the physical decomposition in response to processing an image would be a background worker with a queue of some type. And there's different queuing technologies available. The other thing that we try to make sure that you do when you're thinking about physical decomposition is think about how much workload a single node can actually process. There are going to be limitations of how many images can you process per second versus how many images are coming in on that queue.
I see.
So you may need more than one node, and it's really great because you can scale this out too. You know, you can just simply move that slider for your background process.
There's even a way to scale out the slider automatically based on the density of the queue, right?
Yeah, so Azure has something called AutoScale, and it can monitor the queue, and you can react to this kind of traffic in real time. But you do have to configure that. It's not something that's going to happen by itself.
Of course. So let's be clear. So you talked about two different types of decomposition. You talked about logical decomposition and physical decomposition of your application as we're moving to the cloud. Can you tell me what the logical thing is and what the physical thing is?
Okay. So in this example that I'm giving you, the logical thing would be the fact that you are doing different types of workloads on this one web process. One workload is I'm sending and receiving web requests. Mm-hmm. I'm answering HTTP traffic.
Okay.
A different logical process is I'm processing images.
Got it.
So identifying the logical separation of the tasks that your application does is first and foremost.
It's more of dividing your software up into what logically is happening.
Right. And you may choose a different physical implementation depending on your needs. For example, we do have worker roles as one option in typical cloud pass scenario. Mm-hmm. We also have virtual machines. We also have Azure Batch.
We even have, for
web roles, we now have web jobs, right? So you can run a background task in a web process. And there are many people that rather than actually spinning up a separate worker role, they actually just run a different web app with web jobs running on it. They may not even really use the full features of the HTTP part of that web app, but they're still doing background work in a separate process container.
I see. So the logical separation has to do with your software. The physical separation has to do that now that you've manifested the logical separations, how do you physically want to represent that in Azure?
Yeah.
Got it. Okay.
And when you do that, just making sure that you identify how much load you can put into a single node for that single task.
Got it. Yep. Perfect. All right.
So let's move along.
Okay.
So the next thing I want to talk about was scalability. And the diagram we have here is great already because you notice everything we talked about so far has been above this line.
Yeah.
We haven't talked about the database.
It gets fairly, like this, I know a lot because usually we just sort of heap things over to the DBA.
Yeah.
But now as developers, we have to sort of think about this part too. So I'm actually excited to see what you have
to say. So I want to talk about partitioning. So first, let me erase this. So data partitioning usually becomes the bottleneck because we know how to scale worker nodes and web nodes and other compute-related things, but often we don't know how to scale our database, so we just end up scaling up rather than scaling out. Right?
I think my confusion, and maybe you can address this, is that with web applications, it's just a process accepting and returning requests, and we can duplicate that.
Right.
But the database is the database, and sometimes there's like integrity issues that involve data that we don't know how to sort of replicate.
Right.
Okay.
So there's two ways we can go about this. There's three ways, and I'll talk about the third first.
Okay.
Because that's simple to think about. So if I've got a database, and I'm using that database for two different types of workloads, a great example is read versus write.
Sure.
And I don't necessarily mean like all read requests and all write requests, but image or the image processing we talked about earlier, publishing new images into it would be more like a write request, mm-hmm. right? Or publishing new content.
Got it.
The images might end up actually separate in blob storage or somewhere else, but publishing new rows to a database would be a write. And then actually serving those records out of the database would be more a read. Okay. So what a lot of people do is they just simply replicate and have a read-only replica. So they have a read-write system that they do their queues feed into. And then they have a read-only system that's replicated that they serve most of their data out. Mm-hmm. And what's great about this is that you can actually then just continue to clone this and have as many databases as you want. So this is more of handling load based upon replication and distribution of the data. But you are still duplicating that database pretty much in entirety. Right.
Is this optimizing for the read sort of aspect
right.
of the jobs?
Right.
Because now these databases, reading is fast, right?
Yeah.
And you're replicating these so that you can accept more read requests.
Right.
But when you write, you're still back to the same thing.
Right. So you still have the same thing. And a lot of applications are write heavy. Maybe you're doing something with, for example, Internet of Things. Mm-hmm. And you may be using something like Event Hubs to process your incoming information, but then at some point you actually do have to write somewhere, and maybe you're writing to table storage, but maybe you're writing to SQL Server.
Sure.
Depends on what you're doing. So you could have an application that's very write heavy. Mm-hmm. So this doesn't always work. So we get into partitioning. And partitioning data is an interesting concept, especially when it comes to the cloud, because it does address how do you scale that back end, that right. bottom portion. So there's kind of two different types of partitioning. Let's imagine a table with some columns, and it's got an ID, and it's got a few rows. I'm not even going to come up with examples here. We'll just call them A, B, and C.
Of course. Okay?
So there's the concept of vertical partitioning is actually quite simple. What we say is we look at the usage patterns, and we say, do we always need A, B, and C, or does some of our logically decomposed application only need A, while other parts only need B, or maybe some parts need B and C together? And if we can identify that, there is this vertical split, then we take this table, we still have to put the ID on it, so you end up with another ID, and now it becomes two separate tables. All right? So that's a vertical partition. And the nice thing about vertical partitioning is now you can move this table into a different database entirely. So we've been able to break up our data and say, the entire application doesn't always need access to the entire database. This is a little bit counterintuitive to people that are used to working with the big schema on
sure.
the wall and the big wall charts and say, everything has to be connected to everything. I should always be able to resolve from any stored procedure running anywhere, any table in my view, because
right.
I have a single source of truth, right? What ends up happening here is, maybe sometimes you might actually be duplicating information. You might
I
be
see.
Denormalizing. You might say, it's A, B, but maybe it's not. Maybe it's A and C. So maybe A actually ends up in both tables.
Interesting.
Right.
So now it feels like I was trained in the whole normalized third mm-hmm. or third normal form or BCNF.
Mm-hmm.
This feels like we're going back up,
mm-hmm.
but for purposes of scalability.
Right.
Okay.
Yeah, because now when we send queries for this information, we no longer have to put load on this table. It gives us a nice natural divide. As long as these columns logically align with the types of partitioning we've done on the front end.
I see.
Right? If I always would need information for both tables, then it doesn't help.
And also, if you're writing A, and you're always writing A, this might be a bad write optimization.
Exactly.
Got it.
So there are trade-offs, and you have to think about this carefully. But vertical partitioning is one approach. So the other approach that is quite important, and I'm going to spend most of the time talking about here, is horizontal partitioning, or we call sharding. So if you haven't heard that word before.
Yes, I've heard it with a lot of NoSQL stuff.
Yes. So you can shard in SQL as well, okay? So we've got our, so here's how we think about sharding. And actually, you can combine these techniques.
Sure.
I'm not gonna talk about the hybrid approach because it's fairly obvious. You just do your horizontal and you do your vertical,
yeah.
right? But we'll talk about the horizontal. I didn't make this table big enough. So I've got, again, A, B, and I'll go ahead and just make four columns here.
Cool.
And what I've also got is some IDs, right? So I've got 1, 2, 3, 4. And maybe this row gets very, very large because I've got, 10 million
for this table,
things
right.
I need to think about,
right.
right? That's too much to put in one database. It doesn't scale, especially depending on the workload. I mean, not to say that there's necessarily a hard limit. Mm-hmm. I mean, I suppose there are hard limits. You could go look up what the actual hard limit of a single table is, but that's not what I'm getting at here.
It's probably really large, but you're still sacrificing, you know, performance.
Right. How much do I need to do in this table? And no matter how much I think about indexing and the vertical partitioning, I'm still going to end up in a scenario where I've just got too much data in a single database.
Right.
So we want to get it where we can put some data in one database and some data in another.
Right.
So I'm going to replicate the same schema into both tables, but I need I need what's called a partition key. I need to be able to identify when do I go to this database versus when do I go to that database. So a good way to think about this is in multi-tenant applications.
Got it.
So maybe I'm trying to do software as a service, and I'm going to be selling my software as a service to multiple companies. So there's a company ID or a tenant ID, we like to say, that identifies all of this data belongs to this company. And within that, though, I may still have lots of additional data. I might have lots of users and stuff. So it's not like one list for tracking companies. It's that my entire application has many companies it's going to be working with, right?
Sure.
So what we do is we build naturally what's this tenant ID, or you know, you can partition on other things too, but a tenant ID is a very common case. And we say, all right, rows 1 and 2 belong to, I'll use letters here, belong to tenant A, and rows 3 and 4 belong to tenant B, right? And so if we logically do this throughout our entire table, we can now create two different databases.
Per tenant.
Yeah, and maybe, you know, we continue to do this, and we say, all right, A through L are here, and M through Z are here.
I see.
Like having file drawers, right? You don't necessarily shove everything into one filing cabinet. You open the filing cabinet for the thing you want to find.
That's interesting. And now tenant ID feels like if you're running, but what if you're running a regular application? Maybe C represents the country.
Right.
And you have users all around the world, and you find that, well, you have a lot of people in China, and you have a lot of people in the US. Could you shard on just the country?
You can, but typically you want to shard on a single item. The key with sharding is that whatever your partition key is has to be denormalized to every table that you're going to be sharding across.
I see.
So if you do have like a lot of users in the US and a lot of users in China, but you're treating them all as a whole, well then maybe country is a natural tenant ID or a natural partition key. But you will then need to make sure that even on a table that has nothing to do with country, maybe it's you know, pictures like we were talking about earlier, you know, you'll still need to put a country code on it. So it might be a little bit unintuitive.
I see. Okay, yeah. Makes sense. Because then you lose some of the referential integrity that you need.
Right.
Okay.
And this isn't necessarily a compound key, because it's not like you're not going to have 1A and 1B, right? You're still just have ID 1.
Yeah.
But you'll have some additional information that helps you locate where that is in your database.
It's kind of like building an index into your table, almost.
Yeah.
Like you have your list of phone numbers, which are always unique, right? But then you have the A for all the A phone numbers and a B for all the B phone numbers.
Right.
Okay, got it.
Like having two different phone books.
Got
right?
it.
If you've seen it, they used to, in the old days, they used to the yellow pages and you'd have your A through L and your M through Z. It's the same idea, right? So at time of write, you need to know which database am I writing to. And at time of query, you need to know which database am I querying from. Now, sometimes you may have a query that spans multiple databases, right? Mm-hmm. So that becomes a parallel process and can actually be done more efficiently in some cases. If I need to say, give me one row for every customer that's spanned out across 10 databases, I can blast those out, do all 10 at once, and aggregate the results. Right?
I see.
If I'm doing them one at a time, it might take a little bit longer.
Yeah.
It depends, though. I mean, if it's 10, probably not, because you know, just the way that SQL works with tables and pages and stuff, they're all in the same database. It's not going to matter.
So,
but if it's a lot of data, then it could matter.
So my confusion now becomes, okay, now we have two databases, but it feels like we need to have some other thing in the middle that the application queries that then needs to know to go.
So we call that a partition map.
Okay.
Right? So we have this map, and it can be lots of different implementations. There are lots of different ways to do this. There is no one way to do horizontal sharding. It can simply be a data file, a config file that says, you know what, these are our hard partitions. And this A through L is on DB1 and M through Z is on DB2. That's all you are ever going to partition by, then that works. But most of the time, you need to think about, you know, I'm kind of in a dynamic environment. I might be partitioning by like a GUID, Global Unique Identifier, or some randomly assigned integer key. I may have hotspots in my data where I say, well, it's A through L, but actually customer G needs a database of their own, right?
Oh, I see.
So we get into this interesting scenario where, and let's draw it a slightly different way.
Okay.
Some customers in traditional line of business, especially SaaS applications, would do this kind of sharding, but they would do it one database per tenant, right? So they would say, okay, I've got three customers, therefore I have three databases.
Right.
I'll clone them all, and I'll just say this is customer A, B, and C, right? So I will go and connect to the database for my customer. This is very, very common. It also does not work very well in the cloud, both for scalability reasons and for pricing reasons. When you have to pay per database,
it gets expensive.
It's very expensive, especially if some of these databases are mostly idle or very small. If you have an on-prem SQL server, you're paying for the server, and you can put as many databases on it as you want to, right?
Well, as many
as will actually work on it. But you're not paying per database that you create. Right. You're paying for the overall server implementation. Azure SQL DB, by default, you're paying per database. Mm-hmm. Now, here's the interesting part. There is a brand new feature that's in public preview right now.
Okay.
I don't think it's GA, but it is public preview. You can go in and play with it. It's called Elastic Database Pools. DB Pools. SQL Azure Elastic DB Pools. Now, this Elastic prefix actually applies to a series of technologies that are all about this kind of how do you partition and scale SQL in the cloud. Right, and there's plenty of really good documentation on Azure.com that I recommend that everybody goes and takes a look at. But the nice thing about Elastic Pools, it doesn't actually help with the sharding piece, but it does let you pay for all of these as a single unit. You pay by the total DTUs, database transaction units, that you're going to use across the pool.
Okay.
So if you do have a lift and shift scenario where you're like, you know what, I've been using this app for years, there's no way I'm going to be able to go in and start adding new tenant columns or re-engineering it. The good thing now is you can take advantage of the Elastic DB Pools feature and spin up a database pool and still have the one tenant per database scheme going on. Now, when this was first announced, there was still a per database charge associated with each database. There's since been a counter to that, and I believe Scott Guthrie has on his blog a really nice post explaining that that per database charge has been removed. So you do now pay for it as a pool
of
the database. So it's very good for people that are doing the single tenant per database. But it still doesn't help with, well, gee, I still have to have 1,000 databases if I want 1,000 customers, right? So from a scalability perspective, it's still not necessarily the best thing to do.
So it might be that the partition is wrong if you're trying to do a tenant per customer.
Right.
Because you might have like you might have like 100 super tiny customers, one huge customers, and now you have 101 databases.
Right.
And that's just not
working. And maybe you could get by with the DTUs provided to you by two databases. Right. And you will pay less for that. Even though you could do them all in one pool and pay for them as a whole, you're still going to be paying less for them when you're just limiting it to the actual number of nodes you need. Remember, one of the things that we try to do when we're talking about scalability is if you were looking at a graph of CPU usage or IO usage or any of these other metrics on any given node, whether that's a compute node, web or worker or VM or a database, if you could see it, you would see a chart somewhere where you've got 0 to 100% usage. Well, just CPU, for example,
sure.
But it would apply for other things as well. And some people seem to think that the ideal chart is around here. And when it is,
you're using too much stuff.
Yeah, you're paying for things you're not using, or you haven't optimized your app to run on that. You definitely don't want to be pegged because that shows that you don't have enough resources to do new things coming in. The ideal load is somewhere around here. You want it in that kind of 70 to 80% range where you say, you know what, I'm using the resources of this machine. And maybe it's not always like that. Maybe it spikes up to that and drops down. And you know, mm-hmm. But somewhere around that range is that sign of a healthy, adequately sized machine for the workload that's being applied to it. So if you have 101 databases and the vast majority of them are like this, and one of them is up here, you haven't done it right.
Yeah, it's like you're prepaying for golf lessons and only showing up to like one of them.
Yeah.
And it just doesn't make any sense. So if we could take a step back, mm-hmm. You mentioned how there's like this for sharding, there, what was that called again? The thing, the intermediary thing?
So we call it a partition map.
So the partition map, mm-hmm. I'm trying to understand, like, if I'm in an MVC controller mm-hmm. and I'm looking for to show customer X, what does that code look like? Am sure. I call, is this partition map like a file that's in memory? Is it another sure. database? What exactly
so
does it
let's,
look like?
So let's assume that you are not doing the one database per right. tenant approach.
You're doing the smart.
And you're saying, okay, database A and B are here, A, B, C, and over here I've got D by himself, and over here I've got E through Z or something like that.
Right.
So you've got all this information, right? You will also have either, depending on your implementation, you will have the map itself can be replicated across all nodes. So you can say every partition has the information about where those partitions are. So if I change my map, I need to update all my nodes with that information. Or if it's relatively static, you can move it out to the application config. Or you can create a head node of some kind that is responsible for controlling that map. But you wouldn't want to put a lot of load on this. It's not there to service every query. It's there to be loaded, cached, periodically used, et cetera.
So in essence, you're like switching connection strings in your DAL based upon this mapping.
Right.
Okay, that makes
That'd
sense.
That'd be a good way to do it. Okay. Now, the nice thing is, if you're using the Elastic suite, remember I said there's multiple things involved right. Elastic. There's DB pools. There's also this thing called Elastic DB tools. And this actually came out first. Okay. The tools came out first. The tools are a client-side set of libraries produced by Microsoft. There's a product team that does this. And basically, it controls all of this for you. You can use the client library. It's a .NET library. And you can. It will let you define a partition scheme. It will let you connect individual databases. And they even have samples for like how do you wire this up to any framework. So if
awesome.
You're trying to do this in a greenfield brand new application, you really should look at the Elastic Database Tools suite. It's a NuGet package. You just pull it in, use it. And it lets you do all of this without having to engineer it all yourself.
That's fantastic. See, because my particular thing as a developer is I've always struggled with, I like having referential integrity. NoSQL obviously has its place, but there's certain things like if you're working in like a, I don't know, you're a bank mm-hmm. or you're doing kind of accounting kinds of things, there are certain rules that always you have to enforce from the data side and from the software side. I always worried about, well, how is this replicated? It feels like with Elastic Database Pools, and especially the tooling, it can handle the sharding for you.
It can. But that doesn't mean you have to use it in order to scale out in the cloud.
Right.
The pattern is that you're doing this kind of horizontal sharding. You're considering that, hey, I may want more than one tenant or partition to be in a single DB,
sure.
but not always. And that you're controlling a partition map either across your nodes in a head node or in some other config.
And usually the partition map is not, there's literally going to be three entries if there's three databases. It's something you can load into memory and just keep in all of your
Web or when it would change is when you decided that you need to rebalance or add new tenants. In that
and
situation.
You're only doing this over the weekend, so it literally might be a file.
Cool.
Yeah. Okay, that makes sense.
And often you can keep it in memory and stuff. So other major database platforms and the smaller ones have this sharding strategy. And some of them handle it slightly different, but it's pretty much the same pattern. There are a lot of NoSQL databases that use this strategy.
Okay.
So it's a fairly well-defined strategy. The great news is that it's come now to the cloud and to Azure SQL DB. And I'm excited about this because, and I don't think it gets enough attention, but it is a very powerful way to make sure that a traditional web app written on the ASP.NET platform can be lift and shifted into the cloud. With a little bit of modification, you can have this nice scale out data store.
And the cool thing is also, you can literally rebalance your databases at your leisure, right?
Yep.
Well, not at your leisure, when your peak times are down. And you can sort of optimize your resources. So say you did scale out to four, but you're noticing that this DB D is actually really tiny. You might want to shift this over and rebalance.
And so remember I told you there's a suite of tools, right? So as part of, I may be mistaken, I think it's part of the pools suite, and maybe it's in the tools. In one of those, there is actually management features built in so that you can identify nodes and move data around, which helps with exactly what you're talking
and
about.
And you might even do like a job, a job to do that every once in a while.
There are two other products called, they're all Elastic DB SQL, Azure SQL, Elastic DB pools, tools, jobs, and the other one is query. So jobs and queries are really interesting. Jobs is a really good way to say, you know what, I've got all of these sharded databases, but I mean, what do I do when I need to apply something in batch to all of them?
Right.
Maybe I've added a new column to a table, right. So it's a schema change. Or maybe I'm mass inserting a bunch of records into tables that are in every partition. So jobs will let you queue that up, and then it goes off in the cloud, and it works on those things and does them, and then comes back and gives you status. It's very, very cool. Query is a feature of the pools, which means that it does have to be set up as an elastic pool, but it basically lets you talk to one node, whether it's the head node or one of these other nodes, as if it were a single database. It basically lets you, you know, imagine this as an entire single database. What's really great about that is maybe you have applications like, for example, Excel. Maybe you actually have a scenario where people have data-bound Excel grids, and you've gone off and connected to a SQL data source.
Sure.
Well, you couldn't tell Excel about your partition map.
No.
Instead, the pool has to manage the partition map, and the Elastic Query feature of the pool will let you basically just query everything, and it manages all this for you. It sounds like magic, but it's just doing all the things that you would have done in your application up on the cloud, at the cloud level.
I see. So the next obvious question is, why wouldn't you just use Query for all of your queries when you're doing the web application, instead of having in memory the partition mapping?
Yeah, you can.
There's going to be a performance problem, right?
Yeah, there's trade-offs to both.
Okay.
Managing the partition yourself has a lot of benefit to a SaaS provider. You get a lot more control. You get to be able to say, these are the hotspots. This is how I want to define my partitions. This is how I want to move things around. And if you are trying to develop an application that is a software as a service application, mm-hmm. you probably want those features in your backend. You probably want some management API or DevOps API where you can see on a dashboard, here's all my hotspots and here's how I want to move things around. So when you go to the query approach, you're kind of yielding control back to the pool.
I see.
You're basically saying, this is now the responsibility of the pool. I'm going to use it for query and let it manage talking to all my partitions or whichever ones it needs to. Maybe it's fanning out to multiple, or maybe it's going to a single one, and pull all that data back together and give you my response. So you might actually use both in your application.
I see.
But it wouldn't preclude you to just go with the client-side tools. And you actually don't even need Elastic Pools to use the client-side tools. And that's why I said the client-side tools came out first before the pools was even a feature. If you've already got five databases, for example, if it's a small number of databases and you say, you know what, they're in different data centers, so they're geo-replicated maybe, or maybe they're actually, I've got a US database and a European database.
Right.
Then the pool isn't going to help you because the pool has to stay in a single data center,
right?
Within a single subscription. But you can have from the client side, you can just say, well, here's a DB connection string and here's another DB connection string, and it can go out and query both and interact with them as if they were the same. There you are paying for each database separately, but you're using them as if they were one.
I see. So we talked about decomposition, logical and physical. We talked about partitioning your database vertically and horizontally, and how we could do that with sort of a partition map, how we have ElasticDB tools, jobs, and queries. Yep. What else is there? There's got to be more.
Yeah, there's a lot of things. So the next thing I want to talk about is density. And what do I mean by density? So we kind of touched on this a little bit. So let's talk about density. I have a node of some type. And when I say node, I mean anything. It could be a VM. It could be a worker load, a web node. It could be a database. But for argument's sake, we'll just say you've got code that you wrote.
Got
that's
it.
Running in this process, right?
Okay.
And we talked about how we don't want to see that node idle because we're paying for resources we don't need, right? So one of the best ways to achieve high scalability in the cloud is to really try to maximize density of nodes. If you have 10 nodes, you want to know that all of them are running up in the 80% range, right? Mm-hmm. So there's a few ways we can go about that. The first way I want to talk about, actually I don't even need the box here, is with asynchronous operations. So many platforms have asynchronous operation features. .NET, I'll talk about, uses the async await keywords,
sure.
Right? And we've had plenty of really great content and documentation about async await, and I think a lot of developers get it. There's actually a really great series on Channel 9 that I love from Lucian Wishick.
Yeah.
I think I pronounced his name right. It's six async videos, six async tips, and they're about 15 minutes each. So I recommend that people watch that. It's a really good series. But the nice thing about async, and I think a lot of people kind of have trouble understanding async, is that if you've just got a single process and you say, you know what, this takes a long time, you know, this is something that takes a while, and you're gonna return this back. So this is inline your controller. You have your request and you have your response, And, you know, it's doing something. It's not necessarily compute heavy. Maybe it is, but for the most part, these are I/O operations. I'm talking to a database. I'm talking to a cache. I'm talking to anything that's not on that box. Even if it's on the box, if it's on the file system, you're still talking to an I/O bound resource, right? Async doesn't make this run faster. That's the thing people don't get.
They think, and it's not threads either.
Yeah. It might take advantage of threads, but not necessarily. Yeah. And it doesn't speed it up. So we get feedback a lot of the times, and I've talked to people about this, that I made it async, it doesn't seem any different. Like, well, how are you measuring that? How are you knowing that it's not any different? Well, I ran the same set of tools I always ran. Like, well, those run on your box, you know, maybe a few at a time, maybe one at a time. Maybe you did generate some load, but you're still just doing it from a single source. You're not necessarily seeing the advantage. The biggest advantage with async is that when you go make this request, this thread can leave, which means you can do more things on the same node. You can increase the density of that node so that it's free to do other operations.
And when you mean density, you mean CPU usage, right?
CPU usage, network usage, even the I/O usage.
Right.
You can get more out of a single node when the resources aren't sitting here spinning their wheels waiting for something. That's what we want to avoid in an application. If you've got a tightly bound loop that's just saying, is it done yet, is it done yet, is it done yet, you're kind of wasting your money. And whether you realize it or not, when you do a synchronous I/O operation, if it's just connect to database, read from database, and send, if you're doing that using the traditional synchronous APIs, in the background, the computer is sitting there spinning. It's waiting for the SQL server to complete its task, and then it's moving on. But it's blocking. We call it blocking. It says, I can't go forward until you give me back a result.
Yeah.
So async is a really great way to make sure that applications scale. So I recommend async controllers in a web API. I recommend async I/O operations. And even async when you're doing background processes. When you're reading from a queue, you read asynchronously, and you're doing that work. The work itself isn't necessarily asynchronous, because it is taking up compute resources. Mm-hmm. But you don't necessarily want things blocked waiting on it. If you can do other jobs in the background, you don't want to be consuming those requests I/O threads.
Yeah, I always like to think of the CPU as like an assembly line. It's boom, boom, every time, boom. Mm-hmm. It's like, and then what happens is if you have stuff that you're putting on the assembly line, and all of a sudden there's this one thing you have to unwrap, the assembly line is going to keep moving while you're unwrapping, right? And so why not just give it to somebody else and still just boom, boom, boom.
Yeah.
Oh, look, I got this back that they unwrapped. Then you put that on. And so that's the way I like to think of async. You might not see any speed up,
right?
But you're going to see density or usage.
You're
going to
see
CPU
throughput.
Yeah, throughput.
You're going to see more things being able to handle by the same amount of resources.
Right.
And this it works especially well when you have things that aren't in lockstep. If you're load testing by saying the same thing 10,000 times,
you're
probably not going to see it because they're doing them at the same exact time.
Yeah.
In real life, in a production application, requests are going to be varied. They're going to be popping in and out. You're going to be doing a different request over here than you are over here. And we talked earlier about logical decomposition, that we want similar things being done together. But that doesn't necessarily mean a controller will have one method and that's the whole process, right? Typically, an application has a set of things it does. And you want to make sure that if any of those things is going off and waiting for resources, that it's not preventing something else from happening.
I see.
So that's really all there is to it. And there's not even any technical magic here, other than just realize that even though a lot of the documentation talks about async await from a UI perspective, you know, like in Windows runtime applications and other stuff, async await has a lot more power than just UI applications. And really, I recommend it for anything that's going to be running on a server platform.
Yeah, because if you're blocking, you might not be able to have another request, but if you async that thing, you'll be able to take another request while it's waiting for the I/O operation.
And maybe you can take another request because it also depends on how many threads are available and how much memory is on the machine, et cetera. But at a certain point in your scale out story, that will become the bottleneck.
All right.
So, so that's async. The other thing that we could talk about from a density perspective is an anti-pattern that I like to call chatty I/O. Before I do that, I want to also mention that my team, Patterns and Practices, has a whole series of patterns and guidance available for Azure.
Sure.
And you can go to github.com/msPNP, and you'll find many repositories there. And one of them is called performance optimization. I believe it's performance.
And even if it isn't, I'll put it below the video so you can click on it.
Optimization, or it might say perf opt. I can't remember offhand. But so in here we talk about all the different types of things that you might be doing that a lot of them seem pretty obvious. We did have a lot of discussion on our teams. It was like, is this really something people do, or are they smarter than that? We're like, no, real world scenarios, people make mistakes. And people aren't necessarily paying attention to everything. So.
And it might not be that. It might just be that my manager said, I need this done by next week, and you do the fastest thing, and it's okay, it worked, but now as you're getting into moving to scale, there's some fixes that you need to do, and that's okay too.
Right. So the one pattern I want to talk about is something we call ChatEIO. So this, again, we'll use the, I have a worker node that's doing something and I have a database, right? So often we will get into a scenario where I need to do a set of things. And I've written my application in such a way that maybe in my domain model or in a repository somewhere, I have operations that do very unique small things, right? And what that tends to translate to is that I've got a lot of things in here in a loop, and then each one of those is calling back and forth to the database.
Oh, I see.
And this can amplify very large. There's this anti-pattern, similar anti-pattern associated with it is also called select n plus one.
That's right. I thought of that right away. Is that the same thing? Yeah.
It's similar. Sometimes it's just because you're doing 10 different things, so there's not really an n. Select n plus one is a typical example is an order with order details.
Sure.
Right. So I have one thing I'm doing, which is the one, which is getting the order, and then I have n associated operations that go along with it, and that is chatty as well.
And this might be even a more of a generalization of select n plus one. You might have an operation that requires you to do 10 things.
Right.
And each of those 10 things needs to call some kind of IO kind of operation. I need to get the file here. Right. I need to update the database here once I read the file. Once I update the database, now I need to update the file.
Right.
And if you do that, it's like you're going back and forth everywhere.
Right. And we've shown again and again through performance testing, through real world actual samples that we've pulled down from customers and run through labs, that the more requests you have going back and forth here, the longer these operations take. And again, if you're doing them synchronously, you're kind of blocking on the same point. So hopefully they're asynchronous, but you want to reduce these as few as possible. So there's two ways to think about this. The general way is use the features available to your platform. If this is a SQL database, it may not be. It may be some other platform. It may be Azure Table Storage.
Just
it may be
data.
Blob Storage. It may be
a
Redis
file,
cache or a MongoDB or anything. When you're doing that, you want to use those platform features the best you can. Now, in SQL Server, we have stored procedures, which are really good for doing multiple things at the same time in a single request.
Mm-hmm.
So don't be afraid to use them. We also have batch operations. I think people forget about this. We have SQL bulk copy. We have bulk APIs, batch APIs. So if you are uploading 1,000 rows, don't call an insert statement 1,000 times.
I see. Yeah.
What you want to be doing instead is either using the bulk APIs, which is a different kind of API request, or you want to be using something we call table value parameters. You can look up TVPs for SQL.
Got it.
And basically this lets you define a set of data to pass in as a parameter, and you would use it in conjunction with a stored procedure.
It feels like when you're looking at an operation that's happening, you should think about what IO things am I touching, and how can I only touch them once?
Right, or as few times as possible.
Right.
If it's one or two or even five, that's kind of pushing it, but it's better than N or 100, right? And many, many times applications get chatty like this. The other way that applications get chatty like this is when people decide that they want to store their logs in SQL Server, especially if it's the same SQL Server. Because now they say, well, I've got a database, and I want everything in my database. So especially if they did the one database per customer, they say, well, all my customer information in that database, including all their logs. Well, that means every time you do anything here, you're doing that operation, and you're writing to the log file.
I see.
And that's something that really could be put on a queue and written to a different table and put in a different structure.
Because it doesn't matter. It doesn't enhance the user's sort of feel for the application, so do it sometime later.
Do it sometime later, or at least do it somewhere else.
Right.
If you have to log to SQL, create a second SQL database. This is kind of the vertical partitioning mm-hmm. story, and write the log operation here. And if you can, write it on a background thread or write it in a queue. You know, some way to keep it separate from, I've got to get this thing done and get back to my user as fast as possible.
I see.
Okay. So that's kind of all I have to say about density.
Okay.
You know, watch the idleness and watch for chatty operations and try to not block on I/O.
Yeah. I mean, and if you do have to, you have to do I/O. And but if you do, try to do it once and yeah. fast, or as least with the least amount of sort of yeah. going back and forth as possible.
And it is... it is kind of obvious as we talk about it, but it is very, very common that people don't think about these things. So if it isn't something that you've thought about, it's not your fault. I mean, it is kind of the way that you've been guided over the years, and it right. is the way that people build applications. So we want you to get thinking in the mindset of build things in a more scalable manner to begin with. And if you have to go back and retrofit a few things, that's fine.
Yeah, but you know what? The smartest things I've ever seen in computers were obvious after I learned them.
After you learn them, yeah. exactly. Okay, so let's talk, I've got two other subjects I want to talk about on this pattern. The next one's gonna be really fast, and this is just performance in general.
Cool.
So the big, of course, statement here is you have to monitor your application. You have to monitor it in production.
Right.
You can't just say, we tested this, and then we turned off all of our logging because we want our app to run faster in prod. What's probably going to happen is that the load you hit in production is not going to be the same load that you tested under.
It might be a lot less.
Yeah.
I mean, it might not necessarily be as much. So everyone always thinks, well, I'm going to get slammed, yeah. but you might not be getting as much, and you're wasting resources, which leaves us from the sort of the suggestions from before. Yeah.
So we like to think of it in terms of telemetry. That's the key word to use when you're talking about your boss. We have to know how the ship is being steered, what's happening. You know, did it just hit an iceberg? We need to know these
sure.
things in production, and you have to have some kind of way to measure in production. Now, there's lots of ways to go about this. There are built-in tools to the Azure platform, including Application Insights, mm-hmm. Which is kind of a free add-on to all of our platform as a service offerings. There are third parties like New Relic and AppDynamics that mm-hmm. work really well. And there are plenty of other approaches as well. There's grow your own solutions, and there's multiple different third-party
right.
solutions. The point is be doing it. Okay. The other thing I want to say about performance monitoring is people tend to see performance data in spikes and dips, and maybe what they're looking at is like averages, right? Maybe actually that wasn't drawn very well. Let's think about it like this. So I've got an application, and I've got a spike. Like that. Mm-hmm. And what they tend to look at is this line, like just above their average, and say, you know what, this is mostly okay. They're looking at the wrong thing. This spike is indicative of a problem. Now, you may say, well, it only affected a small number of users. This is most of my traffic. What people don't realize is that performance tools especially work by sampling. Every time you're seeing part of this graph, there's actually kind of a rectangle in here. It covers a window of time. That spike may be right in the center of the window where you're not seeing it. You might be seeing the average across the window, or you might be seeing the point at the front or the point at the end. It really depends on how it was sampled. So you may actually have many spikes in here, and you just didn't see them all.
And you got lucky here because the box fit right on the spike.
Yes.
I see.
Yes. And there's lots of other ways that can be said. Now, if you really only have one blip that happens, in a month, maybe it's not something you want to investigate, spend all your time on. But I would say that the more you focus on the edge cases, the more the general performance improves.
I see.
Okay, so be watching for those big spikes or big dips, and think of those as actionable items.
Sure.
Right? Now, when you go to take action on that, a lot of people like to say, well, we've got a problem in the FUBAR system. Let's go analyze the FUBAR system, spend 6 months on it, and make it more performant. That's the wrong way to go about it. The right way to go about it is, I think I may have identified this bottleneck. Well, first try to measure the bottleneck.
Mm-hmm.
I think I may have identified the bottleneck. Change one thing. Don't try to fix many things at
and
once.
And then watch.
Redeploy.
Right.
See if you still have the same problem. You may find that this one went away, but a new one popped up. It's like the kid with the fingers and
sure.
the hole in the dam, right? You
sure.
want to make sure that as a whole, you are plugging one thing at a time and not trying to just repave over the whole thing.
Got it.
So that's an important part. The other thing I'll say is that if you were to look at like typical usage and plot it on a bell curve, for example, most people will say, well, the traffic I care about is in here. Mm-hmm. It really isn't. It's not even in here. It's more this area. You don't necessarily need to be going all the way to the end, but you really want to be watching for what happens to this number of users. And if I'm talking about good to bad or whatever, these are people that are having perf problems. These are people that are not. Or maybe this is quantity of users. There's lots of different ways of thinking about it. You want to be thinking about that upper average use case or the people that fall into that segment of your performance profile. Because anything you do to improve them is going to affect everybody else as well.
And this might also be your Black Friday shoppers that you totally hosed on your website.
Exactly. Because I didn't get to that scale until Black Friday.
Yeah, and that by that time, it's already
right.
Didn't make any money Saturday.
So do tests not in production, but don't solely rely on testing and QA and testing and staging. Make sure you have telemetry in production, and make sure you identify performance bottlenecks and tune things one at a time.
Awesome.
As you do this, you will see your general performance go up, your scalability go up, other things like that. All right, and then the last thing I want to talk about is just, we are patterns and practices, and I am a developer, so I like to think about dev patterns that can make applications work better at scale. So we talked about, the idea of queuing, right? So queuing is kind of an implementation detail for doing background work.
Mm-hmm.
But what do I do in my application to make queuing kind of possible? Well, there's two different ways really to write an application that interacts with customers and with data. You can write it in what we call CRUD, which is create, read, update, delete.
Mm-hmm.
Or you can write it in something we call CQRS, which is command, query, responsibility, segregation. Lots and lots of material on this on the web, some from patterns and practices. We actually had a project a couple years ago called CQRS Journey that went very well, so you can read about it in depth. There's a book published on it. There's lots of material from Microsoft. There's lots of third-party people and open source people to talk about CQRS.
Sure.
CQRS is a pattern that you should learn if you want to build applications at scale in the cloud. It's not always something you can apply immediately to a lift and shift scenario, but if you are in a greenfield scenario, I want to build applications that scale well, you probably want to design them around the CQRS pattern. So let me talk a little bit about what CQRS means.
Sure.
I'm not going to give you a full dissertation, but the general idea is that I have a request that comes in, and I'm going to do something in my database. And I might then replicate that to a separate store. So we'll call this like our read-only store. And then that information goes back out as a response, right? So maybe it's, I'm going to go ahead and draw it separately. Response. Now the general CQRS pattern actually isn't about this, it's about this. It's that request and response aren't necessarily synchronous. I didn't do that when I'm doing write operations. So we talk about commands and events. So if I'm querying data, sure, I'm going to go in and I'm going to query it against the database and return it. That's the queue part, right? Mm-hmm. But if I am writing information, I'm going to send a command as part of my request. I am going to act on that command with a handler, we'll call it.
Which is a separate logical part of the application.
Right.
Okay.
Something that's going to receive that command, and maybe I even queue it here. Maybe I insert a queue at this point. And the handler does its work, it writes the database, and it puts a response somewhere. And that response we call an event. The event could go to a database. It could stream back up through the web, through like SignalR, for example. Mm-hmm. It could use WebSockets technology. There's a lot of different ways you can send events around. It may go nowhere. It may be that you have other backend systems listening to those events. But the general idea that you break down a work item into a command that can be queued and then acted upon is part of the CQRS pattern.
And it feels like that very first example we did where we told the system, work on this image, it feels very CQRS-y because we've issued a command, we put it into a queue, and then there was some other machine that worked on it.
Right.
And now the last part of it is it has to say, I'm done, and then you have to handle that somehow.
Now there's another technology that often gets talked about with CQRS, which we call event sourcing.
Right.
So you may hear about CQRS, and then you might hear about CQRS/ES is usually how it's abbreviated. Sometimes people automatically think event sourcing when they think CQRS, but you actually can do them separately. You can't really do event sourcing properly without CQRS, but you don't need to do event sourcing to do CQRS.
Sure.
The main concept with CQRS is that your write operations are asynchronous.
Okay.
So we talked about earlier, you put stuff on a queue and you can now offload that work.
Right.
So CQRS enables that. So I don't really want to get too much more into detail in writing code about CQRS because there's plenty of really good examples out there, and I recommend that people look into them. But do be thinking about, I want to write an application for the cloud. That means I should probably be doing CQRS work rather than writing directly to my database as a CRUD application.
Well, cool. All right. Anything else we can do to help with the sort of the fastness of things?
Well, don't forget about cache. So cache is always great. Sometimes it's an afterthought for people.
Yeah.
Azure Redis Cache is a really great implementation. There's plenty of other caching that you might want to do at different layers.
Mm-hmm.
Cache optimization is a really good way to make sure that scale works well. And the other thing is don't forget about CDN, content distribution nodes. This is also a cache mechanism, but more for static content. Traditionally, people would think about CDN from pushing images out. But think about CDN from the perspective of what kind of app am I writing? If you're writing an app that is mostly HTML and JavaScript, those are static assets.
Yeah.
You can put, if you're writing a single page application, a SPA application style, most of your app can be served up by CDN. You do have to think about how you're going to access your data. There's with CDN, you also have things are running on different nodes, so you have to think about something called cores, which is cross-origin resource sharing.
Mm-hmm.
And cores is basically a way that you tell a web browser, even though I serve from point A, I'm giving you permission to go access data from point B.
Got it.
So you need to think about these things. But if you push information out to CDN, well, now you've got the whole vast network of CDN nodes serving up your content and your application instead of just the one worker role.
Got it.
It's less you have to pay for. Performs better, you have lower latency.
It might even be closer to whoever's querying the stuff.
So cache and CDN are two other things.
So this is awesome. So we've gone through a lot of stuff. I might even break up this video because it feels like there's a lot to digest. Where can we go to learn more?
Sure. So I mentioned before, Patterns and Practices has our own GitHub site, github.com/MSPNP. There are also resources available on Channel 9, like the async videos that I mentioned. Mm-hmm. And there are a few other actual books that Patterns and Practices has published. And I'll make sure you have those links to put into the show notes.
Absolutely. Well, thanks so much for spending some time with us, bud.
Yeah.
Thanks so much for watching. And we've learned a little bit about how to take our applications, move them into the cloud in sort of a responsible way or a better way. Thanks for watching, and we'll see you next time. Take care.